Well, there's a movie that came out a few years, I keep saying a few years ago, and now I'm starting to realize that a few years ago doesn't mean what it used to mean a few years ago. Quite a few years ago, back in, you know, the ancient 2006. Mel Gibson put out a movie, and maybe some of you have seen it. I'm not recommending it. That's not what this is. But it was a movie that actually, as I watched it, held a few significant moments that I really appreciated. And one of them was brought back to me this last week. It was a movie called Apocalypto. And in classic Mel Gibson form, it was very violent. it was very gory, and told the story of a young clan, like a tribe of people back in kind of the Mayan times, but they actually more represented an Aztec kind of society. But it was supposed to be in Mayan times, and the young warrior that kind of follows his story as his tribe is attacked, taken captive, and his journey is one where he is taken captive, but his wife and child and she's quite pregnant is escaped in a well, and he is trying to get back to her. But like I said, there's a number of stories, but the one scene that really stuck out to me that I think is quite relevant in a story that we're going to look at this morning was about his Jaguar Paul was the name of the guy, but his brother had a wife, and they were both captured, and the mother-in-law, and the relationship between the brother and the mother-in-law through the movie was quite funny, but you know they she was after him a lot, and you kind of get the sense that she was a bit of a matriarch in the clan, and a little bit you know, you didn't want to get on her bad side, let's just say that. So anyway, they get captured and they get brought into the city, this Mayan city where they were doing a number of things. One of the things they did is they collected all the women and they took them to the market, and they started to sell them off to people who could come and buy them and bid on them, and they would start to take them away, and so they started to do that, and women started to disappear, and as people bought them, they would disappear. Until it was just her left, and being old, you know, older, not having much value, definitely well past childbearing years, the shop kind of closed up, and people stopped buying, and she was left there alone. And there's a moment where the son-in-law and the mother-in-law share this moment where they look at each other, and it's a pitiful moment for the son-in-law to look at his mother-in-law, and it's kind of like one of those moments that they kind of grabs you a little bit, because though she almost is free, nobody cares, nobody wants her. She's standing out in this alley. Everybody's walked away. She has nothing. She has all of the ability to look after herself has been taken away. All the ability to have someone look after her has been taken away. She is left utterly alone with no way to survive. And there's a hopelessness in her eyes as she realizes that this is happening. And it's shared with the son-in-law. It's just a brief moment. There wasn't words really even spoken that I remember of, but it was the look of complete hopelessness and pity. And I want to share with you this morning, we're going to start on a journey, and we're going to go for the next 6 weeks. And where we end up today is going to be drastically similar. And I want to, if you don't get anything out of today, when we start in, we're going to be looking at the book of Ruth. When we start in, I want you to grasp and understand that total, utter sense of being alone, being empty, not having a hope. Because that's what we will see as we move on. We're going to look at this story. We're going to look at the book of Ruth over the next 6 weeks. And it is a story of sacrifice. It is a story of loss. It is a story of loyalty. It is a story of the providence of God, the overall providence of God, doing things as not being seen, but in the background, in the shadows, moving. And and not being to understand that. And yes, gentlemen, it is a love story. So, but women, don't let your husbands tune out here. It is a love story, but it's so much more than that. It is not a, you know, your ordinary chick flick that you watch. Because as we walk along these characters in this story, we will begin to see a parallel to our lives, to our Christian lives, to our relationship with the one and only God. And I want you to come along with me in that as we go. We're going to journey through this book, as I said. And, you know, Ruth is a fascinatingly unique book. And Ruth, for me, is actually holds a very special place in my heart. When I was probably in about my early 20s, and I had come out of, Prince George, I had moved to Edmonton, and this was back a long time ago. I mean, me and Jen were just dating at this point in time. Like, that's such ancient history. And we started to attend a church, and I met a pastor, a very good friend of mine, and he spoke on the book of Ruth, and I literally went through 4 weeks where I actually made the decision to myself to say, you know what, I think this is where I want to become serious about my faith. And I kind of made that decision in that point where I said, you come to that point in your 20s or hopefully maybe sometime later, I don't know, where you have to decide, I'm not going to just be my, you know, live off my parents' faith, or I'm not going to just live off whatever, but I'm actually going to make it mine. And Ruth was a big jumping point for me. It means a whole bunch of me. I still have that sermon series. I still listen to it every once in a while. I'm not going to preach that sermon series because I think we have something different for us in these next 6 weeks. But having said that, I want to just point out and take a few times to look at a few things that make this book unique. And you can't even see that. Look at this. That's why I don't do PowerPoint. But for those of you with really good sight, you can look at that, and I'll go through them. But there is some very noticeable, notable things that make Ruth fit in the unique category. The first one is, really, there's only two books in the whole Bible that are named after women, and Ruth is one, Esther is the other. It's not common. And usually, it is because of the character in that story is amazingly profound, and that's no different with us now. This is the only book where you have a title of a book that is of a non-Jew, a non-Israelite. This is a book named after a foreigner, not just a foreigner. It's like we'll get into it. It's a Moabite. I mean, we will talk about that as we go on. Ruth is also fairly unique. In the fact that there's nothing really supernatural. I mean, we just finished Job. Job was highly supernatural. I mean, we got a vision of a conversation that happened between God and Satan in heaven. You see God show up in a whirlwind. There's nothing like that in Ruth. There's not miracles. There's not a lot of supernatural activity. It literally is a story of everyday life in the life of an Israelite family, which makes it unique. And also where it sits in the Bible and what it represents as it transitions us from a time of the judges to a time of kings is makes it quite unique as well. So that's Ruth on a kind of its significance. There's a number of things as well, but those are four main ones that I have. But it's also unique for us in another area. It's unique for us in a spiritual understanding. I'll put this on for those of you with really good eyesight. But spiritually, it's a unique book in the fact that it gives us a really good, a much better understanding and a continuity of the Messianic lineage. So the lineage of the Messiah as we go through time and as we move along, that line of right up to Jesus' birth and beyond, and it helps us to understand key points and key places that are mentioned within the story that come into play, not only throughout the story of Ruth, but also beyond. So it's quite significant in that regard. Why, you know, especially for all of us, as we begin to think about why bringing in a Gentile or a foreigner directly into Christ's lineage, why that is significant for you and for me. I mean, these are questions that we will be looking at and understanding. It also shows an amazing picture of the character of God without ever, like we said, having him show up or do anything miraculous or do anything supernatural. We get a really good understanding of his character, how even the lowest of the low, he will shelter, he will cover. He will not only do that, he will elevate up and he will lift up and he will bless nations through. And how he goes about and how he does those things. And third, it also helps us to see a picture of God's love and his role for the church, and which directly impacts us in a spiritual way. And so it's a very unique, very special book. And I hope that as we go through it, that we will see and we will hear and we will do things that as we read through this morning and in the next 6 weeks, that will shape us, shift us, and grow us to places that we never thought we would go. So that's really my prayer. So I want to read for you as we go through the first 6 verses, and I'm not even going to try to read that, so I'll read it from right here. So Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 to 6. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking with him his wife and his 2 sons. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi, and their 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were Ephratites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they had reached Moab, they settled there. Now came a time Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her 2 sons. The 2 sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other married a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone, without her 2 sons or her husband. Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland." So what I hope to accomplish this morning is I hope that we can lay out a bit of a setting, a little bit of the stage as we move into the real story that we're going to look at next week of this journey along this road that they move towards a redemptive relationship and redemptive community. And so I want to just take a few minutes as we kind of go through and look at the setting that is before us. So the book of Ruth, like we said, is unique in many features, but it's unique in one other feature I want to point out to you. In its original state, and in its Hebrew, in the Hebrew scriptures, it's actually attached to the book of Judges. They're actually one book, and we separate them in our modern translations into 2 books, but that's not the way that it was originally. And so when you look at the book of Judges, when you read through it, it's quite interesting, a book on its own, to say the least. But what was I going to go? Well, there it is. Okay, yeah, so I knew it was up there somewhere. So when we look at the end of the book of Judges, there's a verse there, and it ends with in chapter 21, verse 25, and it says, "This was before the time of the kings, and everybody did what they thought right in their own eyes." And that's how the book kind of ends. It's a kind of almost like a very downer, like it's a downer book. Things are not going. You start to read the stories that lead up to it, you can tell they're doing things that they feel is right in their own eyes, and it is not good. And it spirals downward. It keeps going, it gets worse and worse as you go through the book of Judges. And and when you begin to see that, when you begin to get that last verse, I got to get it here. It says, "In the days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was in their own eyes. When you begin to realize that that ends the book, but not really meant to end the book, that we're supposed to lead into Ruth out of that, if you don't really realize that, you can read Judges and just be like, oh man, this is hopeless. Like, this is not going to go anywhere. It's going to leave you depressed, actually. And then you start into, Ruth, and it tells you that this is a story that happened during the time of the judges. So it's a story that is going on while these people are there doing whatever they feel is right in their own eyes, and they have no real sense of asking God, of seeking God, of following God at all. They're getting themselves into trouble. They go and they get, their sin gets them into judgment. Then God delivers a judge to them, and the judge isn't always a great person either, usually not. Gets them out of trouble, but then they fall back into it again, usually worse. And it just continues to go round and round. And that's where we find this story happening, within that realm, that time of the judges. And as you read through, like I said, you have all these people, and they, whatever seemed right in their own eyes, they were their own boss, they had their own opinions, they had their own thoughts, and it felt right to them, it looked right to them, so they would do it. They would just go out and do it. When you look at this time, this kind of setup towards it was like a continual moral and spiritual decline, just dropping into more sin, more judgment. Continual consequences in the form of oppression, other nations coming in and defeating them, taking them over, and then as well famine and natural disasters would come and happen on them as well. And the most usual natural phenomenon came in the form of famine. And in fact, when you begin to look at this famine that they were living in now that led Elimelech and his family to leave, when you follow that through and you look at scriptures such as Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, you begin to see that the people, when God's people live in idolatry, when they do exactly as Judges says they do, when they start to begin to live a way in their life that says, we will do what we want, we will worship who we want, we will do the things that seem right in our own eyes, God will judge them with a famine. He will harden the ground. He will make it like bronze. It will yield no crops. Your trees will bear no fruit. Leviticus 26:19. And if you continue reading on in that Leviticus chapter, the punishments get drastically, drastically worse until the people will turn back and be obedient. And so this is the time frame in which we find the story of Ruth. This is the setting. They're in a famine, most likely because they're not living, they're not following God, they're doing what's right in their own eyes, and life is not good for them. And so it's no surprise when we begin the story of Ruth during this time of Judges, when everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes, that we find this famine and we find Elimelech with his family deciding that they want to leave. We're told about a man, and he's not even named in the first chapter, a man from Bethlehem in Judea. And I want you to mark that name and that description of him, because it's important. They don't just say that for fun. It's important, and there's a reason for it. And the man leaves his home and heads to the plains of Moab, taking his family with him. This man's name was Elimelech, which most common scholars say means "my God is king." That's what his name means. And his wife's name is Naomi, which also means beautiful, means pleasant, it means good. I mean, if you were to use these names, it would sound like, and their names were to reflect their character, Elimelech would be he's a godly man. God is his king, and he's a godly man. Naomi is a wonderful woman. She's generous, she's kind, she's pleasant, she's beautiful. But they're getting out. They got to get out. And there's been a lot of speculation as they leave, as they guide out, and Elimelech takes his family and he moves to Moab. Whether it's being a good move, whether they're being disobedient by even leaving under a famine, they should live under famine. They're not, the reason they're under famine is because of their disobedience. They're not following God. They're following other things. And some of that may be true in Elimelech's case and his family. There are other stories, though, in the Bible where people leave and they leave famine, and it's good. I mean, Joseph Holt brings his family out of famine and saves them in Egypt. And so there's other stories where you kind of have to line up there. So I wouldn't be too hasty to judge Elimelech at this moment in time and to call this direct sin. It's important for us also to note, as we just look at these scriptures really quickly, the famine doesn't go into Moab. They go to Moab to get out of the famine. It's not a great distance to go. So in Israel, there's famine. In Moab, there is no famine, which can lead and lend itself to the fact that Israel is under judgment from God in their famine for being idolatrous. So off they go. Elimelech packs up his family. You know what? I can't really blame him. If I'm thinking about my family, there's lots of family people here. We want what's best for our family. And so Elimelech packs up his family, and he heads to Moab to escape the famine, to escape things. They have a couple kids, Mahlon and Chilion. Now, if names are to mean anything in this book, and I believe they are, they're not healthy kids either. One means sickly, and the other kind of similar. They're not healthy kids, and so maybe that's another reason why they pack up their family and they go, they leave. It could be a thought. But they go into this land of Moab. And Moab is, I think I have a slide for that. Yes, Moab, there we go. So Moab is an interesting land. When you read through the book of Judges and Numbers and beyond before you get to Ruth, Moab and the Israelites interact a lot. There's a lot of things that go on here. They have an odd relationship. It's like sometimes they're at war. Sometimes there's a story of Ehud, the left-handed Ehud with the sword. Everybody know that story? Keeps his sword on his right or on his left leg so he can draw it, but they only check his right. And he goes and he kills the king of Moab. And the king of Moab is so fat, he stabs him that the sword actually disappears into his stomach and he dies. Do you know that story? That's the king of Moab. You don't know that story? Okay, it's Judges chapter 3. Paul? 3. So there you go. There's a lot, I'm telling you, it's a weird book, Judges. There's a lot of weird things going on. But they have these interactions, so they kill the king of Moab. And yet it seems that other times they're free to wander into Moab and live there. So it's an odd relationship. There's Balaam and the talking donkey. You know that story? Okay, Balaam is a prophet of Moab, like of the god of Moab, and he's coming, and an angel stands before his donkey, and won't let him go any farther to curse the Israelites, and so there's all these interactions, all these connections between Moab and the Israelites, but the most significant one is how Moab came into being. And this is very interesting as we move forward. So Moab came into being actually in Genesis chapter 19, and it's the story that follows directly after Sodom and Gomorrah, when the angels come and show up, and they take Lot by the hand because he just will not leave that sinful city. And they haul him out, and his wife turns around to look, and she turns into a pillar of salt, and the only ones to escape is Lot and his two daughters, and he takes them up into the mountain, and the angels take them up into the mountain. They had to be drug out. And so there's this giant flame, brimstone and flame coming down and pulverizes everything these two children of Lot know. I mean, when you read through it, you can almost say, like, they must have thought the whole world was gone. The only people left alive on the planet was Lot and themselves. And so they devised this plan. And, of course, it's the incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. And the two kingdoms are made. The Ammonites and the Moabites were these children from these relationship. A disturbing, dark beginning. And it says right in there, they were the enemies of the Israelites till the end of their days. So that's where the Moabites come from, this land of Moab. It was the land that Lot, when Abraham and Lot, and Lot took Abraham, or Abraham took Lot and let him choose where he wanted to go, and he went and chose the land, and then Abraham says, you know, raised up his eyes, and God gave him his land. And so that's the connection. And probably the Moabites took over some part of that, their father's land. They probably separated it. And you have this beginning of two new kingdoms that will forever be a thorn in the side of Israel and the Israelites. They worshipped a god named Chemosh, who was like a perverted version of the one true God, as all gods are. And he was, and so they have a broken, dysfunctional beginning, and they have a broken, dysfunctional God that kind of mimics almost the one true God and his people all the way through. And from its very origin, it was just an abomination. There we go. They just muted me. They thought I was going to say something bad. It's an abomination of not trusting God. Lot did not trust God. And he was drug out by God at Abraham's request. And all through, they don't trust God. They have their own god, Chemosh, and they just continue on in this dysfunction. Lot's daughters didn't trust God to provide for them husbands, and they made this plan that forever would be a problem. And so, even some say, you know, Moab is Mo Abba, which means children of my father, children of the father. And it's, like I said, very dysfunctional. And it begs the question for us as we begin to go forward. What possibly, if anything, good could come out of Moab? What good could come out of Moab? And that's the setting for our story. We are sitting in Moab. We are sitting at this time of the Judges, this place which is defiling, a horrible history, and constantly a problem for God's people. And that's where we find ourselves. And so the next one, I want to look at the stage. As we look at the story and we actually look at our Israelite family. They moved in, it says, and they settled in this land. And we're not told how long that they lived there, but the fact that they had settled could suggest that they were there for a while. They were there for quite a long time. They began to become comfortable, maybe. Very quickly, however, the story tells us, although the timeline is quite a bit longer, we're told that tragedy strikes this family. And Elimelech dies in Moab, and he leaves Naomi without a husband, which is a problem, but not totally a chaos for her, other than the mourning of losing her husband. But she still has her two boys to look after her. She still has her two boys to marry, to carry on the family name, and they do marry. They marry a couple of Moabite women. As we said, Orpah, which one guy says is actually who Orpah was named after, but they spell it, anyway. True story, yeah. So she was named after Orpah, but they spelled her name wrong, so she's Orpah. And I think Orpah sounds better. But so they do marry, and so life is going to continue on, and things, you know, will be okay. They'll have a family. The family name, which is very important in Israel, will be able to continue on. And Naomi now has taken the lead role. She is the matriarch. She is the one in charge, and she is husbandless and probably feeling somewhat alone in that, but she has her boys. And they marry these Moabite women. Now, it's unclear. Some will side on one side, some will side on the other, whether this is an abomination to marry Moabite women. There is a list of Canaanite town, city people that they were not allowed to marry. The Moabites do not show up in that list. But still, the spirit of the law was that if they cross marry, they marry into other countries like that, the fear was that they would begin to follow false gods. And that is still a fear, as Moab has their own god, and he is not the one true God. So whether it was illegal or not, it was not ideal. And it probably speaks more to the fact that as they began to live in Moab, I mean, there wasn't a lot of Israelite options, and it began to become more like home for them. But then we read again that tragedy strikes again, and now Mahlon and Chilion also die. They also pass away. And now Naomi is left with no husband. She is left with no children. She is left with no, they never had grandchildren. Though they were married for 10 years, they did not produce any grandchildren. She has no heir. She has no one to look after her, to carry on the family name. And it's not to be missed that that is, in fact, the worst fate for an Israelite family, to not have anybody to carry on the family name and to have it disappear into out of existence. As one man puts it, she faces her declining years with no children to care for her no grandchildren to cheer her spirits. Naomi is a stranger in a foreign land, a victim of death and of life. In some ways, the first six chapters of Ruth are just a continuation of that book of Judges. I mean, it's just continual, more tragedy, more bad things happening, and it is not ideal for poor Naomi. You can almost see her standing there, losing hope. I just get that picture of that woman I seen in that movie Apocalypse, losing hope, losing faith, losing all of these things, the light just draining out of her eyes as she realizes that her fate is now very dismal, very poor. She is left empty. And just as she is standing there being left empty, word comes to her. We read in verse 6. And a small glimmer of hope. Verse 6, then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah back home by giving them good crops again. And so Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave to return to her homeland. The famine had come to an end in Israel, right at the right time for Naomi, I can tell you. Her daughters-in-law, as well as she, they prepared to head back to her people. She does not know how it will turn out. She does not really go back to anything. She does not know if there will be any reprieve for her emptiness, for her hollowness, for her brokenness there. But if God is providing blessing, perhaps, just perhaps, there will be some small blessing for Naomi. And so she packs up. She takes her daughters-in-law and they begin the journey. And so as we enter into the story of Ruth in this setting and on this stage, in which I believe it was meant for us to lead us to this very point, hopelessness, one small glimmer of hope. Up until now, Naomi was making plans for her life. Naomi and Elimelech, we're going to go to Moab. We're going to go here. We're going to do this. They were living, she was living her life. She was calling her shots. And now she has come to the end, completely emptied out with nothing. Not once anywhere do we see in those first six verses, Elimelech, Naomi, anybody, ask God, pray to God, ask him what to do, where they should go. Not a repentant heart anywhere. Not even one word to God. In fact, the first time we hear about God in this book is in the sixth verse. And I have to ask the question, you know what? As we move into this story, I want you to think about this. I want you to wrestle with this. Are we any different? When we think about our lives and the frailty of the things that we believe we hold on to with such security and such confidence, with what we think we control, are we much different than Naomi was in the land of Moab? In the time of the judges, they did what each one thought was right in their own eyes. And in these first six verses, not once, as I say, do we hear about God. Verse 6, the only one to talk about it, says that the Lord was blessing the Israelites back home. You know, as we think about that, I want us to really, in some regards, step into where Naomi is. Do you seek the Lord? Do you seek him? Do you search him out? Or do you live what you desire to live until you need him? Until all is taken away from you or things are taken away? Do you seek him before that? Do you look to him to set the path, no matter how insignificant you think it is? Do you look to him to set that path for you? Do you look for him to guide you and to move you? Do you make your own plans? Or do you do what is right in your own eyes? The latter will always leave us empty. It will always leave us at a place where we will be unfulfilled, where we will be hopeless. But when we raise up our head, when we look up, and we recognize that God is blessing his people, that God is not quiet, that we must be quiet, and we see that God pours out his water like a famine-ending rain, I don't know what you call it, but he pours it out onto us. And he's waiting and he's calling us to be able to pour that out so that we can drink it up, so that we can be filled up with him and not relying on our own strength, relying on our own ways, our own plans, our own way of doing things, but relying rather on him. Then there begins to be a small shimmer, a small glimmer of hope. And there is hope for Naomi as she prepares to journey on that road back to her home. She has no idea what that how great that hope is, but she knows that in some small way there is nothing for her in Moab. There's nothing for her outside of the family of God. In fact, this story started off with a famine. It started off with a famine in the land of Israel, but Naomi realized in her journey that the famine that she needed to worry about was the famine in her own heart, as she was outside of God's family. And her life began to dry up. And everything began to die. And that the only way that she could nurture that soul was to get back on the path towards her life with God and towards the family of God, the community of God. This story is about hope for all of us. And as next week, when we look at Naomi's traveling partner, who is about to take center stage in this story and in this drama, I want us to come with a full heart, a full understanding that our hope rests not in the things that we can do with our own hands, not in the things that we can do to move outside of God's plan for us, or outside, or to do the things that we think is right in our own eyes, but only when we turn and we realize that God's plan for us, God's desires for us, is the only way that we are fulfilled, that we escape the dryness, the deadness of life. And so next week, as we look at this story and we get into the real story, the real conversations, the real look at Ruth, I hope and I pray that you come full of hope, full of an understanding that this story is going to lead us to amazing places, amazing things. And I pray that God meets you along this journey as we go about it. So will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, as we give you thanks for your word, we thank you that that we have this stage, that we have this setting set before us as we enter into this amazing a gospel story of Ruth, this good news story. And Lord, I pray that you would set our hearts, as you have set Naomi's, on a path of hope. You would set ours on a path of hope as well, as we walk through this redeeming story. God, we give you thanks and we ask your blessing on your word. In Jesus' name, amen.